The Criminal Justice Subcommittee will come to order. Ben, please call the roll.
Chair Trunau?
Here.
Vice Chair Barnaby?
Here.
Ranking Member Rayner?
Present, yes.
Representatives Abbott?
Here.
Baker?
Here.
Brackett?
Here.
Gracie Davis? Representative Brannon has been excused. Representatives Casello? Garcia?
Present.
Gottlieb?
Here.
Jacques?
Here.
Michael?
Here.
Blaken?
Here.
Silvers?
Here.
Stark?
Here.
Tuck?
Here.
Yarkowski?
Thank you, Ben. Before we begin, a few reminders. I will ask everyone to please remember to silence your electronic devices. Also, as a reminder for our members and presenters, please ensure you turn on your microphone when you are speaking and off when you are finished. I also request that you please fill out a public appearance card if you intend to speak before the committee today. Members, welcome to the first meeting of the Criminal Justice Subcommittee for 2024 legislative session. I am honored once again to serve as your chairman and am looking forward to working with you all on some very important issues. Before we get started today, while we have lots of familiar faces in the meeting today, we do have a few new faces joining us today on the staff this year. I'd like to introduce, sitting next to me, is Ben Eisenberg, our new administrative assistant. And in the back row, we have our new subcommittee attorney, Spencer Butcher, and this year's legislative fellow is Tara Yeager. Welcome them and remind them as we begin another year that the staff is here to help you with any issues or questions relating to the subcommittee's jurisdiction. So please do not hesitate to reach out to them if you need assistance. As members remember, the subcommittee was very busy last year, and we heard many bills that ultimately passed and were signed by the governor. To that end, I have invited the Department of Juvenile Justice and the Department of Corrections to provide us with implementation updates regarding legislation that has passed last year. I'd ask that the members please hold your questions until the presentations are complete. I'll open the floor up for questions after they have presented. Well, let's get started. So today, first, we are joined by Dr. Eric Hall, Secretary of Florida Department of Juvenile Justice. Secretary Hall is here today to provide us with an update regarding SB 7014. The bill was carried in the House by our own Representative Jacques and required the department to establish the Florida Scholars Academy within its residential programs. Dr. Hall has more than two decades of experience with executive leadership roles, with significant expertise in the fields of education, youth development, and juvenile justice. In November 2021, Dr. Hall was appointed Secretary of Florida's Department of Juvenile Justice. Before his current role, he was appointed in 2019 to serve as state's first chancellor for innovation and senior chancellor, where he oversaw divisions of K through 12 public schools, the Florida college system, career and adult education, vocational rehabilitation, blind services, and the Office of Safe Schools and the Office of Early Learning. Dr. Hall has served on several boards and committees, including a board member of Special Olympics Florida and as chair of Florida State's Advisory Council on Early Learning. Secretary Hall, welcome and thank you for being here today. You are recognized.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much. And good morning, Vice Chair and Ranking Member Rayner. It's good to be with all of you as committee members, and always appreciate the opportunity to stand here and be able to provide updates on the work that we're doing at the Department of Juvenile Justice. You know, thank you for that introduction, Mr. Chair, and I want to start by thanking many of you that over the last few months have had an opportunity to go out and visit with our centers and visit with our students and our youth, our staff, and really get familiar with our operations. I think that's important as we continue to build on, you know, the good work that I'll talk about this morning, but also the work that we have ahead and really trying to make sure that we continue to lead the nation in juvenile justice. And just kind of start out this morning, you know, it's kind of amazing to think that, you know, just a few short months ago, we were standing here talking about the possibility of creating a statewide unified school system. And here we are today with legislation that has been passed, you know, the support of the governor with the budget and the legislature to be able to go into this new innovative model of helping to provide high-quality education and post-secondary opportunities for the kids in our system is really something that is long overdue, but it's also an unbelievable opportunity to reduce recidivism for the young people that we serve. Before we jump in, for some of you that may recall last year, I talked about my first 6 months on the job. You know, when I was appointed in November of 21 and really hit the ground running in that December, I spent those first 6 months going around the state, visiting all of our facilities, whether they were detention centers, residential programs, engaging with our court partners, meeting with law enforcement agencies, and with our school systems. And that was about really trying to understand what are the priorities that we need to be thinking about in the years ahead for juvenile justice. What are the things that we've done well? What are the great trends that we've been able to accomplish? But it was also about how do we build a vision for this organization, for this agency, for the next 10 years to come, so that we can continue to do things like reduce recidivism, continue to drive down juvenile arrests, really have a system that continues to be recognized across the nation as the most comprehensive juvenile justice system in this country. And it's because we're an agency that is focused on prevention all the way up to serving the needs of youth that are served in our max risk facilities. That's what differentiates us, because we can focus on the front end by helping to reduce a juvenile arrest with prevention programs, and you hear me talk about this oftentimes. I know Representative Bracey Davis, you always smile when I talk about organizations like our Pace Center for Girls and other organizations like SensFens, where we're providing respite and other intervention services to help keep kids out of our system, using models like civil citation to reduce juvenile arrests. All those things are critical in our system, but as you make your way through our continuum to the middle part of our system on probation and then eventually into our residential system, it's really important to understand that we have great outcomes and great trends, but, you know, good is only good when better is not expected. Some of you have probably heard me use that statement before. We've done great things, but, you know, the hardest thing in the world is how do you go from being great and continue to go in that direction when you have outcomes that are showing, again, those reductions in recidivism, showing that we have reductions in juvenile arrest, all the things that, again, I'm very proud of our agency and our partners across the state that have been involved in this work. But during those 6 months, we said, okay, what is the vision ahead? And that's where we launched our strategic plan called the Pathway to Impact. And it's really built around four cornerstones. And what you'll find is what I'll talk about here in a few minutes about the updates on the Florida Scholars Academy. It's built around these four pillars. You know, it's about how do we have world-class talent and leadership to deliver high-quality services to youth that we serve, whether that's in our community-based programs, whether it's in our probation services, or in our residential and detention centers. We got to have the best staff out there on the front lines working with our kids, and we got to have the leadership in place that can drive the outcomes that we want to continue to achieve. When you look at data-informed decision-making, we have the most robust data system in the nation when it comes to a juvenile justice system, and we use that data each and every day to drive system improvement. We're going to continue to double down on that as we go forward, but using that data to drive continuous improvement is critical to our mission, and now that we can do that as we go forward in the area of education, again, that's going to be a game changer, and I'll talk more about that in just a moment. Implementing evidence-based practices. We have a great history of using evidence-based programs, but at the same time, as we go into education, how do we make sure that we're using the best strategies possible to meet the individual needs and ensure that every student that we're serving in our system has a pathway that is unique to their abilities, but also unique to their goals and the aspirations that they have, as well as their families, for their long-term success? And we'll talk more about that. But going down to that fourth pillar, which really to me is critical across our continuum, it's understanding that we got to make sure that we have our young people on a pathway to academic achievement and what happens beyond graduating high school so that they are on a path to a career that helps them to be able to really be on a pathway to upward mobility. And that's what this is all about. When we had this vision for the Florida Scholars Academy, and you know, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for recognizing Representative Jacques. You know, Representative Jacques, thank you for your leadership, as well as our co-chair with Representative Valdez, to really come out and help support this piece of legislation that created this opportunity. Again, it's a game changer. But I wanted to start here so that you understand that this is not just about creating an education system. It's built around where do we need to go. It's about what is that vision ahead. And it's not in isolation. It's in coordination with the other things that we're doing as a system. Which brings us to the Florida Scholars Academy. I don't want to read to you, but this is really about how do we have this new statewide unified system. To give you some context in the current situation, and of course, this is our implementation year. We're building out the infrastructure, getting things in place, and I'll talk about that more in just a moment. But this year, as we're building this out, you know, currently, right now, and it's been this way really since the inception of the department, is that wherever a residential program sits, that local school district is providing the education in that center. And either they can provide teachers inside those facilities, or they can subcontract with a local provider or a provider to provide those services. And it's all built around the FEFP, or the education funding model, that's here in our state. Now, a lot of our districts, they're doing, you know, good work, and they're making sure that they're, you know, addressing the needs of our kids. But the challenge that we have is that when you have a decentralized system like this, it's very hard to have a coordinated effort around curriculum, instruction. When you have a system like ours that sometimes requires, I may have to open a new facility, or sometimes close a facility because we may have to make adjustments in our system. That means we're moving students around, and what happens is when you start crossing county lines, you can have disruption in the educational system. And at the same time, when you have a disconnected system, you know, we oftentimes will find where we have a young person who has gotten their GED or gotten their high school diploma, and they're inside that center, and oftentimes that's where you will see where the system stops short right then of providing education because they're no longer enrolled in that local school system once they have their high school diploma. So that means for those students, they're not sitting in a classroom getting instruction or support to continue their progression. These were the barriers that we wanted to remove and look at. How do we ensure that every youth that's inside one of our residential programs has an educational pathway that is built around a funding model that is not bound to the K-12 FEFP, but is bound to the potential of each individual student? And that's what we're doing through this model. You know, with the unified school system, we can now look at, again, curriculum. We can look at how do we train teachers using evidence-based practices and strategies that we know can accelerate learning and close academic gaps. How do we look at having students who can now leverage the opportunity to maybe be in college, taking courses either through online platforms or enrolling through a local state college or a technical college? These are all components that, again, as it currently sits, are significant barriers to the opportunities that we serve with our youth. So, again, we talk about good is good, but better is expected. We've got to continue to drive that home, and that's, again, for this year, where we've been with building out the implementation. Now, while we're still very early in the process, let me tell you a little bit about what we've been doing over the last few months. Back in May 19th, we went ahead at that point. Legislation had passed. Everything had been signed. We were at a point then where we wanted to go ahead and put on the street very quickly a request for information to see who out there might have an interest in being the provider. And just to kind of, you know, reflect a little bit on the legislation, the way it's written, it gives us the opportunity as the department to contract with a school district, a university, a state college, or an entity that has a proven track record of being able to provide high-quality education. And so we put out the request for information to see who out there would have an interest in wanting to be a partner on this project and to be able to potentially be a lead agency to work and deliver what we're, you know, committing to through this model. From that, on June 30th, when the request for information closed, we had four responses, and all great organizations, but I would tell you, I think what we found is that there's a lot of people that have great content, but to be able to go from, you know, scope and scale of running an education system from Pensacola all the way to Miami with classrooms all across the state, that's a pretty big undertaking. So we've had to spend a lot of time really going through and working with the interested individuals that have come forward, in some cases talking with state colleges, some school districts, taking this deep dive in the conversation so that we can better understand who really has the system-wide capacity to do this work with us, again, as that unified, you know, system provider under contract with the department to do this work. So at that point in time, it was exciting. You know, July 1st, you know, we were real. We were like, okay, you know, laws passed July 1st, we're real, we're hitting the ground running. We can start accessing the dollars and the resources we need to start working towards implementation. And since that time, as I mentioned, we've engaged with a number of stakeholders. I want to call out, you know, a couple of colleges, you know, one particular, you know, St. Pete College, who worked with us very closely so that we could use their collab lab. They sat down with us. I want to thank the president of the college who opened up her doors and her resources to help sit down with us so that we could strategically think about all the moving pieces of creating a new statewide school system. So her and her team were phenomenal as a partner in that space. And we've talked to several districts in this process. And I can tell you, you know, going through that, you know, having run schools, having, you know, been involved, you know, most of my career in education and also spending the first 16 years of my career in juvenile justice, I've been blessed to kind of have this, you know, this opportunity to look inside of our facilities and understand the nuances that we have to navigate, as well as our team at the department. But going through that, I'm going to tell you, we are really in a very strong place. Yes, we're about, you know, 3 months, or a little bit more than 3 months into this, you know, now this first quarter of the fiscal year, and we've got a lot of work to do by July 1 of 2024 when we officially will cut the ribbon to start operations with the Florida Scholars Academy across the state. That work early on here, sitting down with these partners and these stakeholders, has been tremendous, and I want to thank them for their engagement. The next thing that we really moved into, you know, we were, you know, fortunate early on to have our board appointed, because in statute we do have a board that oversees the ability to establish rule policies, but also ensure that we're holding ourselves accountable as well as the provider to the outcomes that we need to achieve for our kids. So this is not about just having a contract that the department is managing. This is about having a board that can ensure, like any other school district, how are we accountable to the resources and the outcomes that we want to drive for the young people that we serve. And so when those appointments were made on August 24th, in statute, I can tell you I'm very humbled and privileged to serve as the chair in statute of our board, but very, you know, also happy to see that we have members that represent the business community, individuals who understand policy and background here in our state. You know, having Bob Ward, who is the current, and he's retiring as the president and CEO for the Florida Council of 100. Looking at Chris Moya, who has a strong background in policy and has done a lot of work, actually, with some of our providers earlier in his career. Dan McGrew, who is a vice president with CareerSource Florida, because, again, if we're talking about those post-secondary opportunities, it's great to have a board that can help us think through how do we remove barriers and access additional resources to support our kids after they get, you know, through high school graduation. And then looking at Marva Johnson, who, you know, with Charter Communications, yes, it's her day job, but her background has also been as the board of the State Board of Education here in Florida. And so comes to this with a high degree of understanding in governance and policy as well, having sat on the State Board of Education. So very excited. We had our first board meeting on October 10th, where we went through, you know, of course, some of those initial requirements with ethics training and everything that we have to do as a board and to make sure that we are, you know, in compliance with all state requirements, but also provided an overview and a background of our entire system so that our board members understand wholeheartedly the work that we have to do going forward. Again, big benchmark in this process is you know, establishing a board. Now we're at that point of being able to hopefully move into the direction of getting operations up and running. You know, we have our website now established on our DJJ page where you can go to the school system and you will see all of our public documents for things like public notices, for example, for our board meeting, the agendas. Everything that any other school system board would have to do are the same things that we're doing under this new school system model. We have our logo. These are the things that, again, they seem like small wins, but no doubt they are definitely wins because we are starting to position this and prepare for that first day of operations, July 1 of 2024. You know, I can tell you right now, you know, the biggest lift, of course, is finding that provider. So I can tell you that we are in the final stages of finalizing our contract with the provider, and very confident that we are within days of being able to announce who that is, and look forward to coming back. And as soon as we make that final determination and literally sign a contract, we will make sure that the committee members get that update immediately and make sure that, again, you're aware of the direction that we're going. But I want to talk a little bit just about the, you know, responsibilities that are going to fall on the provider, because I think it's one thing to think about running a school, but when you think about a provider who's going to be under contract to deliver outcomes that we're looking for, you know, it's one thing to find a provider that understands K-12. It's another thing to find a provider who can work with other partners in post-secondary education and training, and also work with a partner that understands how do you have immediate infrastructure for things like a student information system. You know, those of us that are parents understand sometimes we get messages from our children's school through some of the systems that they use. Well, if you think about that, imagine how are we going to have that opportunity to do the same thing with our kids, getting information to their parents while they're back home in their away from their families while they're in a residential program. How do we engage parents? That's a big piece of what we want to do. You know, when you think about having curriculum and content that can be tailored to the individual needs of each kid, you know, I would say, you know, if we were to look at this committee as a classroom in one of our residential facilities, you know, if you think about each of you as students sitting in a seat, and we have two or three of you that are maybe in 7th or 8th grade, two or three of you that may be sitting in that classroom that are 9th, 10th, and 11th grade, one or two of you that might be working on your GED, those are some of the dynamics that we have to have an educational provider who can understand how do you differentiate education and learning at that level. So those are the nuances that we have to work through, because it takes that degree of differentiation so that you have students exposed to the content that they need to be exposed to, so that when they transition back, if they're in an Algebra 2 class, they need to be able to transition back home to their home community to understand that they've had content and information aligned to Algebra 2. If it's a student who's going to be in middle school, you know, 8th grade English language arts, are they getting content and information that's going to prepare them when they transition back to the classroom? Those are some of the dynamics within our system that we have to navigate, so that we're not teaching everybody the same thing. We're teaching each individual student based on the courses they're enrolled, and also their pathway that they're on. And also recognizing that, you know, nearly a third of the youth that we serve in our system have an ESE or an IEP, their ESE or have an individual education plan. So great nuances involved, but that's where, again, we've taken great care on the front end of this development, this strategic planning, and really building this out along with the contracted provider to be able to make sure that we can address all these unique needs across our system. So we're excited. We're going to look forward to being able to bring that announcement forward very soon. But I think, you know, the magic really happens by making sure you've got that great teacher in the classroom with the students, someone who knows how to, you know, teach to their ability, teach them to be challenged so that we're accelerating growth. But that teacher has to be the center of everything that's happening. Teachers are the ones that make the difference. And so if we can take a great teacher, partner them with the best content available, we do those things hand in hand, we're going to see great outcomes, and we will look forward to coming back and sharing those outcomes, not just in the months ahead, but in the years ahead as we continue to implement and bring forward this really first-of-its-kind model, not only here in Florida, but the first-of-its-kind really in the country, because it is, again, breaking down barriers and funding models, and again, funding opportunities for each and every kid, regardless of their pathway. With that, Mr. Chair, happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Secretary. That was very enlightening. I appreciate the hard work that you guys are putting into this. Members, questions? Ranking member?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and Mr. Secretary. So good to see you again. And thank you so much for allowing us. I know this summer I wasn't able to do that. My staff attended and visiting one of the centers. So I just appreciate just your transparency and just your willingness to kind of bring us into the process with you. I do have a couple of questions, and this may be more this kind of now understanding that we were still waiting for you to announce the provider. This may also be somewhere within their wheelhouse. But I kind of want to talk about when we're thinking about the education markers for the students that you kind of just touched on. I know that you talked about making sure that each student has what they need. I know we've seen in other states that students have individual achievement testing. Like, so for example, in Texas, if a student comes into the system, they have an individual achievement testing. They complete like a vocational aptitude interest inventory. They also do psychological and language proficiency. So I guess my question is that something similar that will be happening in our department here and within juvenile justice? And is that something that you're kind of working with the provider to build out?
You're recognized.
I appreciate that question. Absolutely. We do want to look at aptitude. We want to look at, obviously, the academic background of the youth. We want to look at what are the most recent assessment information that we can access. And I think, honestly, that is a real, you know, benefit as we look at the new statewide assessment model with progress monitoring, because now we can have a benchmark right before the kid came to our facility, and we can look at growth over time and really compare that throughout the year. But I think, to your point, what we want to be able to do is look at, you know, kind of the coordination of all that information, because every youth that does go to a residential program, they have a comprehensive evaluation that takes into account not only their mental health and other needs, as well as medical needs. Now we'll be able to link into that really a strong focus on their educational needs, so that it really is kind of this, you know, it's not just a unified district, it's a unified system working hand in hand with DJJ, so that we can take into totality all the needs of the student in a way that we haven't been able to do in the past.
Follow up?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for that answer. That kind of gave me a little bit more clarity. And kind of along with that, I know that I have represented young people who have gone into residential programs who are highly intelligent, highly very proficient in school. So with that, and this is kind of something close to my heart, is would there be an option? I know you're working with St. Pete College for dual enrollment opportunities for students.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Another great question. I would tell you my goal, and I say goal because these are conversations that we are having, I would love for every student that we have in grades 9 through 12 to leave our facility with at least one dual enrollment class completed, so that we can make sure we're exposing them early on. Now, again, there's some nuances we will navigate with that, but I think dual enrollment is definitely an opportunity that we want to explore and make sure that we're bringing to the forefront, and we have definitely had those conversations with the provider that we're negotiating with right now. If I can add, I think what's really important is, you know, to the point that you're making, is that we got to make sure that we're not having classrooms that are teaching to the middle, or teaching, you know, in some cases to the students that are struggling the most in the classroom. We got to make sure we have the ability to challenge students at all levels, so that, again, students are getting access to that content and information when they go back. Because I think that is one of the challenges that we have, is that if a student is not getting access to that Algebra 2 course that I mentioned, and they go back to school, you know, 6 months into the school year, they're 6 months behind their peers in that classroom, which leads to frustration and other things that can lead to them, you know, not just not only achieving in school, but think about it, those are things that can eventually at some point in time contribute to truancy. You know, let's face it, kids are not unlike adults. We all want to be in environments that we feel like we're being successful in. And so we want to tee our students up to be successful when they return back to their local community. And so that access to great content that's aligned to the courses that they're enrolled is critical.
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for the valuable information. I've got a couple of questions. I know we talked last session about whether or not the... So I visited a DJJ in Broward, but I don't think this program, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is being implemented for children who are being detained for 21 days or longer. What are we doing? And they were getting a great education at the one that I visited, so I do appreciate that. And it was a, despite the fact that it's an aging facility, they're doing a great job there. But what are we doing to ensure that those kids who are there for 21 days or perhaps longer are having the same educational opportunities?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Great question. We want to continue to work with our detention centers and those local districts. And I think to your point, you're absolutely correct. This is focused on, you know, roughly the 38 residential facilities that we have that are non-secure, high-risk, and max-risk facilities where, you know, students would be with us potentially anywhere from 6 months up to, you know, 3 years in our max-risk facilities. So we're focusing there. And part of that is when you think about a detention center where you could have a, you know, a youth come in for 24 hours or just a couple days, if that student has an IEP, for example, that's a lot of moving parts. And if that kid is going to, you know, reacclimate back into their home school, keeping them closer to their local district in a detention center makes sense. I think to the point that you make on longer term, you know, possibilities beyond the 21 days, we want to continue to work with those local districts to see how we can amplify those opportunities. And if the student, you'll see I interchange students a lot. This is my education hat, I'm sorry. The students are the youth that we're serving. You know, we want to make sure that if they're staying in detention for an extended period of time, this is where we can go back and look at the fact that if they're going to be going to a commitment program, how do we start as early as possible to assess what their plan should be so that we know day one when the youth is coming into the facility, we know exactly what they're going to be focused on. So we would like to set some conditions here long term where we can assess much earlier and really understand, is a youth going to be on a pathway for a K-12 education? Are they going to be on a path for a GED? Or in some cases, if they can get a GED quickly, can they be on a path to go into college or a technical college pretty rapidly?
Representative Gottlieb, follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sure this is a softball question, but is there more that we can do then to assist you to make that transition when it's necessary, or do you have all the tools now that you need?
You recognize.
I think it's a big question, and I have to tell you, and I wasn't just saying it for the sake of, you know, pleasantries. I'm being serious. Like, I am grateful to the leadership and everybody involved for helping us get to this point. You know, I think as we come back with anything with implementation, you have blind spots. And so I think as we go forward, you know, into our first year of implementation and operations, there may be more. There's going to be things that we will continue to learn as we look at, you know, fluctuations in youth enrollment in our centers, you know, as we look at, you know, new centers and even looking long term at how we address, you know, the post-secondary access piece. I really want to look at how do we create conditions so that we can get our kids really connected to those technical colleges and state college to continue beyond high school. We're not looking for every kid to have a college degree. We're looking for every kid to have the opportunities that they want for themselves. And how do we keep parents engaged in that process? And I think that's where we want to build that system capacity. But to your point, I appreciate that. And, you know, definitely, you know, softball questions are awesome. So thank you.
One more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final question is, I know you haven't picked a vendor yet. I think one of the biggest problems is turnover rate of teachers. And you just spoke in your presentation about the teacher being the hallmark of the whole system and the focus of the system. I assume you're looking to ensure that there's an appropriate rate of pay so that we can keep those teachers so that your program works. What are we doing to ensure that? And again, softball, is there anything that we can do to help you there?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Another great question. I think, you know, that's part of the conversations we're having with the provider. So as we're building out that budget to make sure that compensation is definitely about getting people in the door. But I think what keeps people there is that satisfaction for the job. And feeling like, you know, they've got the ability to do the things that, you know, most teachers come to the profession to do, which is to teach and educate and build, you know, great positive relationships with our students. And I think, you know, with that, we're looking for a provider who encompasses all that and embraces that and creates opportunities not just for salary, but opportunities for things like state retirement and other things that we know many educators, if they're going to consider making a pivot into this work, those are things that are going to be important to them.
Representative Jacques, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary, I just want to commend you for your excellent work in this area and for the department as a whole. When I was working on this legislation, you were an excellent partner. And to see the work you've done since this has been passed into law and implementing this has been truly commendable. And I just want to congratulate you. you know, my motivation of running this bill was based on my experience as a former prosecutor. And I was primarily responsible for adult crimes, but you would see the rap sheets and you would see that a lot of the adults that were prosecuting, their interactions with the justice system began when they were juveniles. And I've often thought, you know, why shouldn't we be very proactive on the front end, intervening early to prevent them from seeing a prosecutor in the adult system where the options are limited, and I had a job to do. So the research is clear that educational services is a key factor in reducing recidivism and preventing these youth from graduating into the adult crime system, but rather we want them graduating into colleges, into trade schools, into meaningful employment, and I know this Florida Scholars Academy will do just that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Representative Bracy Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I no longer have a question. Representative Gottlieb and I were on the same track as it relates to turnover. So more so just a comment. First of all, I want to say thank you. Thank you for always being so transparent. And I remember one of the first conversations that we had when you spoke to this committee. You talked about your educational background, and I thought it was very interesting for you to be the secretary of DJJ and you'd be so passionate about education, which makes it perfect for a program like this, because I think you're being able to use all of your skill set to really have this program to soar and to fly. So thank you for all the work that you've even done in listening to your presentation, that you were getting moving on this program and initiative even before the bill was signed, so that you could be proactive and really ready to take off. So just thank you for that. And I just want to echo what Representative Gottlieb spoke on as it relates to ensuring that in your vetting of the provider that we really talk about turnover and retention and shortage. Because when we talk to any school system, private, public, whatever, we understand that that is an issue. So I can imagine that will too be an issue even in this space. So continue to have those conversations, and I am excited to hear, perhaps in a year from now, all of the wonderful data and facts and figures that you will present to us in terms of the success of this program. Thank you so very much. Thank
you. Representative Yarkoski, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary, I wanted to echo what my colleague Rep. Jock said in commending you for your leadership. I always say that leadership is not something you just go learn. It's not an ideology. It's a way of being. And I see how you operate, and I hear what your staff says. I got the opportunity to work on the other side a little bit with retention appropriation for a lot of your folks. And I can't tell you how committed these people are to what they do. It's a passion, again, a way of life. I also engaged a lot with the vendors that provide services. You know, a lot of their concerns were, you know, being paid on formulas from 17 and 20 years ago type things. So I was happy to see some business acumen on your board, because I think it's very important that we're getting best-in-class vendors, that we're making sure that we're paying them properly so they can pay their people, because at the end of the day, it's the free market, and if they leave, you know, we're left holding potentially worse services, worse outcomes, potentially for the children. So I love the two components here, and I just wanted to tell you that I see the whole picture coming together, and I've got the pleasure of working in that last year. And I'm excited to be a part again this year, and just thank you for what you're doing. It's very important, our children, and the most important thing we can do up here. So God bless.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for that. Secretary, I just want to thank you for all that you've done. And members, I would encourage you to visit a facility. I think that the Secretary would love for you to have some insight on what's happening on the ground, on detention and residential facilities, and even more restrained facilities. I think that you know, you gain an understanding of what he's going through every day, and hopefully we can continue to tune it in and make it better. So thank you for that. Any last comments,
Mr. Chair? I am grateful for this committee and the work that you've done to support us. I mean, it's blessed to be in a situation where you've got support to do great things for kids, whether that's through budget policy or even looking at the practice of what we do each and every day. We're committed to driving those outcomes forward and do great things and be responsible back to this committee and to the people of Florida on the things that we've got to get done. But we're grateful for the support, truly.
Well, we look forward to working with you and members. thank you for everything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we're happy to be joined by Richard Comerford, Deputy Secretary of Florida Department of Corrections. Deputy Secretary Comerford is here to provide us with an update on Senate Bill 7016. In part, the bill required all the powers and duties and functions related to private correctional facilities to be transferred from the Department of Management Services to the Department of Corrections. Deputy Secretary Comerford is responsible for the operational oversight of the Florida Department of Corrections. Mr. Comerford began his career as a correctional officer in Okaloosa Correctional Institution in 1986. With more than 37 years in the department, his tenure and experience include comprehensive correctional management, institutional operations, investigations, and emergency preparedness and response with 18 years at the management and executive level. Mr. Comerford holds a bachelor's degree in criminology from the University of Florida. He is a member of the American Correctional Association and the Florida Sheriff's Association, and a graduate of FDLE's Executive Leadership Training. As Deputy Secretary of the third largest state correctional system in America, he is dedicated to fostering an organization built on integrity and professionalism and the growth and development of the staff. Deputy Secretary Comerford, we welcome you here today. You are recognized.
Thank you, Chair Trunow. And if I could, just for a minute, just want to congratulate and recognize Secretary Hall as well. It's just an outstanding presentation and really encouraged by what they're doing with DJJ. We work very closely together on issues a lot of times, and just looking forward to the success of this program. But again, good morning, Chair Trunow, Vice Chair Barnaby, Ranking Member Rayner. Thank you again for the opportunity to present here today and give you an update on the implementation of Senate Bill 7016 addressing private prison monitoring now under the supervision of the Department of Corrections. If I could first, just on behalf of our thousands of employees across the state, many of who are watching today, just thank each and every one of you for your support and resources that you've helped us with, not only in this past years, but years past. Many of you in the room today have toured our facilities, you've done ride-alongs with our probation and parole staff, you've attended our employee appreciation events, and your presence and your involvement is priceless, and we just can't thank you enough. The support that FDC has also received, you know, from the governor with the pay raises has been extraordinary as well. The morale in our agency, the increase in morale in our agency is palpable, and that's because of your support. The department currently supervises approximately 85,000 inmates and over 145,000 offenders on supervision. The private prisons we'll talk about this morning houses roughly a little over 10,000 of those inmates. We have nearly 24,000 authorized positions in the agency, with roughly 19,000 dedicated security of the state facilities. We have a little over 2,800 security vacancies today, compared to roughly 3,600 a year ago. So again, we're seeing improvement in our recovery, and again, that's thanks to you and the legislature and the governor, and we're recovering in a lot of areas, but some areas not so much. Now to the topic at hand. As you know, Senate Bill 7016 was passed by the legislature last session and signed into law by the governor with an effective date of October 1st. So technically, we're less than 21 days into the actual implementation and transition. The bill had several requirements, some of which included the transfer of oversight for the private prisons from DMS to DC, FDC, the transfer of all powers, duties, functions, records, personnel, associated support staff, property, administrative rules, et cetera. They came underneath the Department of Corrections through a Type 2 transfer from DMS to FDC. There's also the transfer of any unexpended funds or trust funds related to the private prison operations that came under FDC. The bill also clarified that any existing agreements, bonds, certificates, and other instruments of indebtedness entered into by DMS remained there. And lastly, it removed the ability of DMS to enter into contracts for designing, financing, acquiring, leasing, or constructing and operating private correctional facilities. We'll talk a little bit more about those points in a second, but I want to give you a kind of a rundown of our private prison blueprint, if you will, across the state. We have a total of 7 private correctional facilities across the state, stretching from Santa Rosa County south to Glades and Palm Beach County. Our first private facility, Gadsden Correctional Facility, opened in 1995, with the most recent one being Blackwater in Santa Rosa County, opening in 2010. These 7 facilities manage a variety of missions within the Department of Corrections, from female offenders to youthful offenders, site grade 3 inmates, and also community custody all the way up to close custody. As I stated previously, the private facilities manage a little over 10,000 of our 85,000 plus inmates today. These facilities are operated through contracts with 3 individual correctional services vendors. The GEO Group manages Blackwater, South Bay, and Moorhaven. Management and Training Corporation manages Graceville, Bay, and Gadsden. And Core Civic manages Lake City Correctional Facility. Okay, so where we're at, or actually the transition period, very similar to DJJ, when this bill was signed in May, we took off running. We didn't wait for the, you know, July 1st or the actual signing. Actually, we went ahead and started implementing efforts. We wanted to make sure we had a seamless transition. So we initiated right off the bat in May meetings, weekly meetings with DMS between FDC and DMS. I'd be remiss if I didn't at this point recognize the great partnership we've had with the Department of Management Services over the years as it relates to private prisons, and this transition period was no exception. This summer, Secretary Dixon and I and others met with the DMS Bureau of Private Prisons Monitoring in our central office, and we talked about the vision and where we were going. We received an executive overview of the operations, and Secretary assured DMS and the vendors that we'd work collaboratively to execute that transition. We've always had a relationship and an interaction, but now that the Private Prison Bureau or Private Prison Monitoring is coming up underneath the department, we wanted to learn the ins and outs from an executive level of the daily operations. The department and DMS met collectively with each of the 3 vendors in the months leading up to October. And they got together to talk with our Office of Administration, who is now the division of which the Bureau of Prison Private Prison Monitoring falls under, and kind of came up to speed with the individual contracts and the operations and opening lines of communication. The Private Prison Bureau consists of a total of 15 staff that we acquired through the Type 2 transfer. There's 7 contract monitors, 1 at each facility around the state, and then there's also 8 staff assigned here in Tallahassee for management and support staff. They actually physically moved into our building on the 28th, and we officially transitioned oversight to the Department of Corrections on the 29th. All 7 contracts that are under or in place today were transitioned to us late September through a contract amendment. So where do we stand today? The department is conducting an internal review of all contracts with our Office of Administration, Procurement, and Financial Services. As I'll show you in a moment, we have 6 of the 7 contracts actually coming up for renewal or bid in 2024. And we'll work diligently over the next 60 days to map out that direction and course of action and how we're going to go about renewing those contracts and by always keeping public safety and the efficient use of our resources, number one. We have our Office of Facilities, Maintenance, and Building Construction. They're experts in the corrections field as it relates to management of facilities. They're going out and actually doing site surveys, physical plant inspections of our seven facilities, using their expertise of corrections. We're trying to evaluate kind of a current state of our assets there and what future needs we may have moving forward. We have additional meetings scheduled with the vendors to discuss current operational processes at each facility with the goal of making sure everybody has a full understanding of these contracts. Our private facilities fall into three of our four regions across the state, and we have regional directors of institutions that interact with those wardens and those operations and have for years. But now that we have a direct oversight and responsibility for those contracts, we've got to make sure everybody understands how that flows. And I think at the end of the day, you'll see that our level of supervision and accountability between the contracts, the private vendors, and the Department of Corrections will improve. As it relates to security operations, we've always had our Bureau of Security Operations in Tallahassee. They do yearly unannounced security audits based on the fiscal year, where we go in with a 400-plus object survey instrument or audit instrument. We look at everything from keys to staffing to perimeter systems. It's a very complex audit. And then that's part of the actual contract that holds the vendors accountable. And that won't change. That'll continue. And we actually think we can make some improvements. And lastly, we'll conduct some internal assessments. With DMS coming underneath the department, we feel they'll have some access to resources they never had before. DMS has done a great job managing private prisons. But as you know, they manage from this building here to our health and our health insurance to our personnel matters. I mean, they have a very diverse portfolio. Within the Department of Corrections, the Bureau of Private Prison Management, everybody they reach out to in our agency has a correctional background, and everything we do from our general counsel to our Office of Administration revolves around prison operations. So we feel that there'll be a lot of success to gain there and maybe some efficiencies that we can gain as a team. And then lastly, this is just kind of a breakdown of our seven contracts that we have. As I said earlier, we have six of the seven coming up for bid or coming up for renewal this year, coming up in 2024. Bay, Gracehill, and Moorhaven are currently on the last year of their initial three-year contracts, while Gadsden, Lake City, and South Bay are in year two of a two-year renewal, and we just signed a two-year renewal with Blackwater just prior to October 1st. So, Mr. Chair, this concludes the slide portion of my presentation. In closing, I'd like to say again how grateful we are to have the opportunity to bring the private prisons underneath our overview and supervision, and look forward to improving processes and accountability or resources moving forward, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Deputy Secretary, for that presentation and the insight on how we're moving forward with the Senate bill. Representative Bracy Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Mr. Chair, if I may have perhaps a series of questions. I had the opportunity just on yesterday to visit Santa Rosa. So I have, as a legislator and on this committee, have purposed myself to go visit several of the corrections institutions. I'd like for, and this is kind of a broad question, but I'd like for you if you could map out the differences between policy and procedure between private and DOC corrections institutions as it relates to inmates, as it relates to when inmates are moved. I hear that sometimes with private prisons, because they have to have so many, and correct me if I'm wrong, they have to have so many in the prison that if there's an infraction or some violent issue, that they're not moved as quickly as opposed to at a DOC prison. Could you speak a little to that?
You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, ma'am. So I can tell you today in 2023 compared to years past, it's really a more apples-to-apples operation. There used to be some very distinct differences between the private prisons and the state prisons. As it relates to policy and procedure, by contract, they're required to follow the exact same policies and procedures, post orders, directives, statutes, rules, everything related to Department of Corrections. They're required to follow exactly as our state facilities. If they were to want to challenge something or to ask for a waiver, there's a process for that. But there's very few, if any, that we have granted a waiver for. So they're pretty much held accountable to the same standards. As it relates to discipline, transfer, movement, there is a requirement that we maintain a 90% occupancy of those facilities. It's in the contract and related to per diem. But I can assure you that we have a state classification office or state class office, and they're the ones that manage discipline moves. So if an inmate's placed in confinement for, assaults and things of that nature, we address their movement or transfer to close management or another facility the same as we do with state inmates. As it relates to medical, they're held accountable to provide for the medical issues and medical needs the same as we do in the department. It's depending on their medical grade and how long they're in that medical grade. If they're severely ill or, confined to the hospital, there may be an incident where we transfer them back to us. But for the most part, it's the same. And the other issue, too, that we've seen over the years, and this is also a credit to the legislature last year, we used to be kind of behind times with the private prisons as it relates to programming and education. But I can tell you with the teachers that we were allocated last year and the programs that we're implementing, thanks to the legislature, I think we're even going to be on a level playing field as it relates to programming and education. It'll be a true apples-to-apples comparison.
Follow-up?
If I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a DOC presence at all private prisons?
You're recognized.
Yes, ma'am, there will be now, because in the past, well, actually, we've always had a DOC presence. We actually have a classification staff member at each facility, and they're there to help with the classification processes, the disciplinary reports, the moves, the transfers, and things of that nature. And there's a contract monitor. Prior to October 1st, they were an employee of DMS, and now they're an employee of us. So we'll have at least two DC employees at every facility across the state.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read an article, I think it came out yesterday in the Orlando Sentinel. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It has to do with commissary. And it mentioned, and this was startling to me, and I'd love for you to speak to it, and I know you said some of the contracts are being reviewed. However, it mentioned that mail commissary items have increased as much by 80%. Could you speak to that?
You're recognized.
Thanks, sir. I'm sorry, the last sentence you said what?
Mail menu commissary items have increased by as much as 80%.
You're right. I'm not familiar with that exact article. And if I will say that we are addressing the cost of some of those items. We recently implemented a new canteen contract. And that contract menu is developed by a canteen committee within the agency, utilizing also impact or influence from the vendor. And that is to speak to 80% increase in the actual mail menu. I'd have to go back and research that. But we are looking at the contract as a whole. We are looking at the prices as a whole. There's been Secretary Dixon's committed to looking at finding a way to improve on the prices that was recently increased and try to find an avenue to, better support the operations.
That's fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment, if you would like to read that article, it's very telling. Rising commissary prices in Florida prisons lead to boycotts and outcry. And this was in the Orlando Sentinel on October 16th. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Ranking Member, you're recognized.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And Deputy Secretary, so good to see you again. Yeah. I had the opportunity to be with the department in June because they honored my uncle for their Hall of Fame, so it's good to see you. First, just thank you so much for always the hard work I know that you that y'all do. I do want to kind of shift our focus to the vacancies that are still at the facilities. One, I guess my first question would be, how are you seeing, and I know you're kind of just 21 days into this, right? How are you seeing the vacancies impact the actual day-to-day function of the prisons?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Ranking Member. Are you talking in reference to the private prisons or to the prisons as a whole?
To the private prisons, I'm sorry, to clarify, private prisons.
Yes, ma'am. You're right. They're having challenges as well. Across the state, and again, kind of like us, it's a geographical issue. It's more in the panhandle with their facilities. They are having some challenges in their southern facilities as well. Their budgets, they actually have additional funds that were allocated both recurring and non-recurring to give comparable salary increases to that of the department security staff. So We're as concerned for the private facilities as we are for the state facilities as well. As was indicated, some of these facilities actually share a property line with DC facilities. Mm. So it behooves us to give them the same effort and attention so that they can be successful in recruitment and retention as well, because at the end of the day, they're all supervising state of Florida inmates and, you know, all had the mission of public safety.
Follow up.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much, Deputy Secretary, for that answer. And so I guess as we're thinking about the vacancies at the private prisons and kind of now FDC's role in this world, is it fair to say that the strategies that y'all are using to fill vacancies at FDC prisons are the same strategies that you are hoping to implement at the private prisons?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Well, there's, first and foremost, we've been sharing strategies. Okay. We've worked very closely with the vendors, even while they were under DMS, along with DMS, you know, whether it's billboards or, you know, outreach through Indeed.com and things like that. We've kind of shared our strategies and, you know, again, the Secretary has supported salary increases to make them comparable. As it relates to moving forward, the recruitment and retention and the process for filling these positions ultimately still lie with the vendor. But I think that we're going to have an opportunity to maybe shore that up a little bit and make more efficient use of that. Again, we're just a few weeks into the actual transfer, and that's part of the meetings that we're having, bringing our regional directors in and our central office staff, our HR staff, some of the leaders and sections that never really had a direct connection because all of that was managed by DMS. Now that it's under the Department of Corrections, again, I think using the our correctional expertise will be able to enhance and help them tremendously.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much, Deputy Secretary. I wanted to just ask, you talked a little bit about some of the inspections that y'all have done at these facilities, and if you could, because you have these private vendors who are, and I'll say it, who are may not have the expertise that the correctional officials have with FDC and knowing, like, the work that y'all do, what have y'all learned, and how are we going to maybe kind of bring them in where they need to be that has the level of excellence that we know that our facilities have and strive to have, if that makes sense?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great question, and it's been kind of really a catalyst and a reason why this makes so much sense that the private prisons fall underneath the department. Again, as I said, DMS and their management of the private prison bureau was great, but again, they had so much to say grace over. With the private prison monitoring bureau now being underneath the department, it'll give us an opportunity to have two-way dialogue or direct dialogue with the vendors and the facilities, whereas in the past we had to kind of go through DMS, and it sometimes things got lost in translation or there was a time delay. You know, now when our regional directors go into a private facility, which they have been doing for years, and they see an issue or they see a concern or they see a challenge, they're able to communicate directly to that contract monitor and then back to the bureau chief and the director of administration here in Tallahassee for the Department of Corrections so we can address those issues. As it relates to our unannounced security audits, those findings have always been shared. We go back and we do follow-ups as required. So I think ultimately that level of communication now and direct communication will enhance that.
Ranking member, you're recognized.
How did you know? I just have one last question. When you talked about the being able to see if there are challenges or issues, I guess what kind of is concerning for me specifically with the vendors, not with FDC, but what is the recourse? So if y'all go in there, right, and y'all see, you know, in your expertise, you're like, this isn't right, and then you list those things, you have those conversations with the vendors, and then maybe you pop back up 6 months, 7 months later, and those things, A, haven't been addressed or they've gotten worse. Now that FDC is kind of like managing it, what is the recourse or consequences for the vendor if they have not done what needed to be done, and kind of where does FDC find itself in the mix of that?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, ma'am. If I can kind of go back, I think I didn't fully answer your last question, but you know, as it relates to our private vendors, we're very confident in their skill level and their expertise. They all manage multiple facilities around the country, and we've had opportunities to interact with them. So as it relates to the experience and the competency of the corrections profession, we feel they're very much qualified. As it relates to findings and issues that we see, again, that contract monitor that's on that facility 7 days a week, he or she has access to anywhere on that property, any meeting, any documents, they have access to that facility. And as we find, and they also have a unique audit instrument, if you will, for that private prison that was developed by DMS. And we're, again, a few weeks into that, and that's part of what we're going to be assessing internally about what we feel we can do at the Department of Corrections to enhance that audit instrument. But based off of that audit instrument as it relates to the terms and the expectations of the contract, there is findings that are identified and reported with corresponding financial consequences or cost. And that's part of the reason we do a yearly unannounced security audit because, and it's, again, it's unannounced. It may be, you know, seven months in between, or it may be 15 months in between, but we do it unannounced. It's because they use that audit instrument in addition to their audit instrument, the Private Prison Bureau, to hold those vendors accountable. Moving forward, there'll be some conversations about how we address any lingering issues or, you know, truly systematic issues that are not being addressed. But we have that as a goal and objective to address.
Well, thank you, Deputy Secretary, for your presentation today. It was very informational, and again, I recommend that all members visit some facilities and gain insight on what's happening out there so we can give feedback or be more interactive with it. So thank you for that.
Thanks, sir.
We have a couple of appearance cards. First, we have Connie Edison. Wishes to speak. You're recognized.
Oh, sorry. I can talk loud without it. I just want to introduce myself. My name is Connie Edson. A lot of you know me as someone who represents the Florida State Prisons because we have no air conditioning in our Florida State Prisons. With that being said, I've been working with the Florida Department of Corrections for the last 3 years, trying to bring solutions, trying to bring ideas to bring us to the new century here. Anyway, with that being said, Secretary Dixon and the Florida Department of Corrections has been working, and they've been doing a great job trying to get facilities upgraded, trying to get air conditioning put in the facilities that don't have them. And with that being said, I was hoping to, since you're all here, when they talk about bringing more money for appropriations or anything for facility upgrades for air conditioning, that you think about all the loved ones that are in there. But besides that, in the what he was just saying, that we are 3,000 correctional officers short. You have to wonder why. The government job is a really good job, great benefits, good retirement, but you have to think. We live in Florida. You're wearing two layers of clothing. This last summer was the hottest summer I've ever seen. 115 degrees, it's been calculated, inside of those prisons. And you're asking people to work in there, volunteer in there? This year, you guys were great. You voted on giving, from the annual inmate trust fund, $28 million for the programs, which was amazing. It's idleness is a big problem there, so we were really, really appreciated. However, if you don't have volunteers or correctional officers to oversee these programs, it's kind of a moot point, and the money's really going to sit there. So until we fix our facilities and get that situated on the base level, we really can't move forward. So with that being said, I believe there's been a bill that was just submitted, HB 181, and I hope you will all back it when it comes to voting. Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Thank you for coming. Next, we have Jackie Dunn, representing Data for Change, wishes to speak. You are recognized.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. First, want to say a good thing. I am now on the board of Restore Duval, which is a wonderful women's reentry program, and one of their favorite places to get their women is from Gadsden, because the private prisons do a very good job with programming, more so than what we've seen with FTC having 83% of idleness on a daily, you know, on any given day. 83% of our incarcerated are not in any kind of program. Hopefully with the inmate trust fund money, that'll change. I will also say, though, I urge the Department of Corrections to continue to focus on looking at the incidents and the disciplinary situations in the private prisons. I know that they have some sort of, you know, financial incentive to have closed management incarcerated population. And what I'm seeing, my son luckily is in a wonderful prison in Lancaster and Trenton, where Secretary Dixon started his career. But I have friends that have loved ones in a private prison like South Bay that has stabbings every week. The people aren't shipped. They end up back in their cells. They retaliate against each other. So it's a constant lot of gang activity there. And they don't ship them. When normally if you cause harm to someone else, you get shipped immediately to save everybody from, you know, any repercussions that come of that. So I just urge the Department of Corrections to continue to look over their shoulder in those kind of situations and make sure that they're doing things that are right and safe and not just financially beneficial. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for coming. Next, we have Leslie Matta. And we wishes to speak. You're recognized.
Thank you so much. Okay, my name is Leslie Matta. When I come here and I hear everybody talking, everything is about data, procedures, and I understand that it's important, procedures in any situation. So today marks the first time that I'm addressing the House side. I'm here to show a face to the families of incarcerated individuals. I want you to understand that I'm not very different from any of you. Life can take unexpected turns, and I hope you can empathize with the challenges that families like mine face. During the previous session in February, the first time I had the opportunity to address the Senate committee, they were talking about programs, and Secretary Dixon was there, and Mr. Patrick Mahoney was there. He's the director of programs and reentry, and the programs are great. I learned that there was a specific algorithm that they use to choose who they're going to put in their programs, and it has 100% accuracy of who will reoffend and who won't. The programs are good. I shared the story that at the time, my loved one was actually a teacher at a faith-based program, and while the materials are severely outdated, overall, to help with idleness, the program is good. But once my loved one finished his program and I was waiting for the program transfer, he was waiting, he was moved to a different dorm within that facility. Speaking of how long it takes, and specifically where he was moved felt like, for me, being on the outside, felt like I was constantly living in fight or flight mode, where I was scared at all times that I was going to be called and say that harm came to my family member. Or one time I went to visit this facility, and there was a woman who was waiting for her loved one to come out, and she was waiting there for like an hour. And he nearly died the day before, and nobody called the family to let them know that that's what had happened. And she was just there with her grandson, just waiting for the visitation. And so my loved one is in this waiting for the program transfer, and he couldn't complain to anyone about anything because he's just scared that he was going to be put in confinement. So I stand before you today after months and months of living in this constant fear. I carried the weight of uncertainty, dreading that at any moment I might receive the call of him being harmed. I already said that. My loved one was finally transferred, so right now I'm okay. He's okay. I'm much more calm. But it did leave me with the experience. I want things to change. Things need to change, and I kind of saw it with my own eyes. I felt it. In subsequent speaking opportunities, I advocated for the creation of an oversight committee, and I think that this is something that we really need, maybe a committee, a panel of volunteers to make unannounced visits to prisons like you do. This would be a vital service, providing a channel outside of the prison to address concerns, especially regarding issues like medical care and safety, without the fear of retaliation or being put in confinement, because it seems like confinement is the solution to absolutely anything. Oh, you speak up, you're put in confinement. You have mental health issues, you get put in confinement. Obviously, if you think that you're going to get stabbed, oh, guess what? You're going to be put in confinement. And I'm sorry for my sarcasm. I've just been through a lot. I've also discussed in the different speeches that I've made my discomfort with the procedures during prison visits, especially like the intrusive pat-downs. It's particularly unsettling for children. I've gone with my 11-year-old, and he said that an officer touched his private parts. So
Bring it too close, please.
I'm so sorry. Last week, I was at the only way to truly address these issues is to reduce the prison population. There's already algorithms that we know that can 100% accurately, not my words, the secretary's words, can accurately say this person will not reoffend. We need to start working on programs to get people out so that the people that truly do have those mental health issues.
We thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Next, we have James Barriardi, FIA PBA president of the chapter.
Yes.
You're right.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you. I wasn't going to speak originally today because most of the title was on the private prisons, but I felt the need to do it after I heard a couple of speakers speak. My members have been working short. They worked through COVID. They didn't complain. They went in knowing that there was an outbreak in the facility, and they continue to work. Today, we continue to work short, although things are getting better from your actions, and I'm thankful, and like the deputy secretary said, they're thankful too, but we all know that this body and this governor could not replace what happened the prior 8 years where correctional officers were neglected. Representative, I heard you talk about your uncle, Harry Singletary, and I've served under him. And I remember one day sitting up on the third floor, and he was concerned about funding for the officers. And 20 years later, we're still here talking about it. But correctional officers are good. They're honest people. They go to work, and they work one of the toughest jobs in law enforcement. It's very important that we continue with raises and retention pay, and most importantly, to keep the veteran staff. Over the last couple of years, those people kind of been left behind a little bit. And what's happening now is, the Deputy Secretary touched on it a little bit, some of the facilities are not recovering as fast as others, as both of us would like. And what's happening, we're moving inmates to other areas, to South Florida, where they're being overworked. And when I talk about overworked, it means that you think you're going home that day, and then a few minutes before, you're told you're not, and you have to call your kids and tell them you're missing their soccer practice or their play at school, or that you're told on that you're going to have to come in on your day off for the safety of everyone. So I want to thank everybody for what's going on. I want to remind everybody, we have a saying that we work one of the toughest beats in law enforcement. I wholeheartedly believe that after my 30 years. And I ask you to continue to do the work to keep correctional officers, keep the public safe. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. Members, that concludes our presentations and comments. I want to thank everyone for joining us today. If there's no further business, that concludes our agenda for today's meeting. Representative Tuck moves that we rise. Unless there's any other objection, we adjourn.